Yeah, Peter Murphy. I'm the coordinator of the Search Foundation, and our organisation has had a long involvement with the movements for independence and democracy in Timor.
And how do you see the situation there now? Just a few weeks ago, there were the rioting had broken out again. Has that been come under control?
I don't know about control, but it has not been as intense as it was in the last week of October. And I think that what happened there was because of a vacuum that opened up after the United Nations Special Investigation Report came out, and nothing was really done. So I think that the groups trying to destabilise the government took it as a green light, that they weren't going to be affected by the UN report and that they should push on to destabilise the government more. And since then, those people made a miscalculation by targeting the Australian military forces and police, and this, I think, has backfired on them. And as well as that, the current Prime Minister, José Ramos-Horta, made a significant speech on the 100th day of his new government, which I think signalled a new direction for him. So he insisted that the dangerous armed groups led by Alfredo Reynado and this Vicente Reylos are still at large, and he still asserted in his speech that they should surrender, but that should happen through dialogue. But on the other hand, the speech was much more a positive response to the call from Fretilin for all of the main leaders to reunite for the good of the country. So he embraced Alkatiri, he embraced Fretilin, he called for he acknowledged the work of the previous government and said that that's the program he was implementing, and he had a few new things to add to it, but basically that was the core of his speech. So I think that that was a good sign, and that would also, I think, give pause to the people doing the destabilisation. I know that also at about that same time as that speech, the whole command of the Army of East Timor, FDTL, had a full-day meeting with Xanana Gusmao, the president, and I'm sure there's a lot of problems for them to talk through, but they all know each other very well. So we haven't heard the outcome of that meeting, but the fact that the meeting took place is another positive step, I think.
And you did say there were forces, there are forces working towards the destabilisation of East Timor, and a superficial reading of the Australian press in the past anyway has seemed to have implied that Alkatiri is somehow to blame for this. Can you talk a little bit about what these destabilising influences are, and perhaps a little bit about Alkatiri's role?
Okay. I'd like to emphasise this is my personal view. Okay, the Australian media really demonised Mari Alkatiri, and those people who know him, I think, know this is completely baseless. All these allegations that he's involved in corruption, nepotism, or worse, arming secret gangs to kill people, this is completely ludicrous, actually. There's a dynamic in the politics of Timor that's been apparent for several years, really since the Untayet period of 2001-2002. So two political parties which got relatively small representation in the parliamentary elections, the Democratic Party and the Social Democratic Party, have been engaged in destabilisation since that time. They never accepted the election results, which gave them, the PD received only 7 seats out of 88 in the election, and the Social Democratic Party, called PSD, got 6. And they never accepted that result. They think they should be the government. So there's been, some very violent things have happened in 2002 and 2004, especially December 2002, which the Prime Minister's house was burnt down. There was a sustained sort of riot one afternoon in early December that year. And the PD were calling for the overthrow of the government then. The PSD is led by Mario Carrasquelau, who was a governor under the Indonesians in the period 1988 to 1992, and he also thinks he's born to rule, I think. So this is an old dynamic, and I think that the Alkatiri government had understood this dynamic and thought that it could be managed. That is, that these protests could be handled by a careful approach, not by a lot of force. There should be dialogue, and the sort of fake posturing of these groups would be exposed and they would peter out. The last demonstrations like this were in April, May 2005, so not you know, only last year. These were led by the church, two bishops and some priests, not the whole church, and the maximum size that they could mount for a protest was 3,000 people. And the protest went for 3 weeks, and it finished with, you know, ridiculous calls like that the whole government should be sacked, that Shinano should sack them, and that Mario Carrascal should be the prime minister, and various other political figures from these parties should be ministers, and that 2.5% of all the oil revenue should go to the church. It was a sort of a lost, you know, the bishops didn't really have much political understanding, and they were being used, I think, by Mario Carrascal in particular. Experience. This demonstration had its violent moments. Some people were bashed, and some UN personnel were kidnapped. Even there was allegations of torture by the protesters at that time last year. But the police managed it very calmly, and the 19 days passed, and it ended without any really serious problem. It's already now apparent that at that time, some people associated with some of those bishops, at least one, asked the army to overthrow the government.
This was back in 2005.
Yes. And I know that the Catholic radio station in Dili at the time was calling for the army to kill the Prime Minister. He was referred to on the radio as a Muslim dog. So it was a really lurid sort of, apolitical. These people who were doing it had no idea, in a way, what they were doing or how to behave. That's one of the reasons why I think it failed. Not long after that protest, for instance, there were local government elections all over the island, and in Dili, where this demonstration took place, Fretilin got over 90% of the vote for the local authorities which were established. So, you know, it backfired politically. But inside that problem, you can see that there was a danger, that there were people willing to use arms against the government. And the other factor I'd like to point out, though, is a sort of a bigger picture. Like, there's this dynamic which the government thought it understood, but they didn't, I think, see what was coming with this events this year. Because other people used these negative potentials in the society for bigger purposes.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you know, about how this year was different. Was it simply the role of this Reynado, or was there more experience after the experience of 2005? How was it different this year?
Well, I think this is just speculation, but given what we know about 2005, that the people who mounted that push got some more support, and they decided that, you know, mass demonstrations wasn't the way because they couldn't get much of a mass demonstration, and that more violent means were the ones to use. And then what did happen this year at the start of the year was that the division was created inside the army around this so-called sense of discrimination between East and West, and a significant portion of the army was broken off. So in anybody's terms, this is a much more dangerous situation. And the way I read it, from examining all the news reports and having seen the United Nations investigation report, there isn't really a lot of explanation for this except politics. That is, that the only person that we know, even up till today, who didn't get promoted because he might have come from the West was this Lieutenant Salsinha. But we know in fact that he wasn't promoted because he was caught smuggling sandalwood across the border into Indonesia and trucking beer back. So he was given the soft treatment of no promotion, whereas he should have really been arrested, except that there's no military, at this stage in the short life of the country, there's no actual martial, what do you call it, court martial's law for the military to operate. So there was really no mechanism easily to deal with a crime like that in the army. So Lieutenant Salsinha was able to generate, with some significant support from outside, this movement in the army. That's the best I can say on the evidence, that there's no real case that there was widespread discrimination. It may yet be proved, but none of the people claiming it have come forward and given any evidence to anyone offering to take evidence off them. So I think that, you know, knowing a lot about industrial action, if you really don't want to solve the dispute, you just keep escalating the demands, and that's what really happened in this case. So I think that that was the most significant political development earlier this year. It created a climate of tension, and it created a situation where the president, Gusmão, started to separate himself from the government. So in March, he said that the sacking of these striking soldiers was a mistake in a speech to the nation. So that gave heart to further escalation, in fact. In the same speech, he said he wouldn't change the decision either. So it was a very ambiguous speech.
Both ways, yeah. You started telling us how pleased you were, or having, you're quite impressed with the Horta's latest report, and I think a lot of Australians they see Horta and Guzman, Xalanar Guzman, as being they're the most high profile East Timorese leaders certainly in the English speaking world, and not many people know that they are separate from the Fretland Party, although it is good to see that Horta is happy to work with the Fretland Party as such.
Well, just on that, yes, Xanana Gusmão left Fretland in the late 1980s to enable the creation of the National Council of Maiberia Resistance, CNRM, which was a political initiative from Fretland to enable groups that were outside Fretland but which were now strongly opposed to the Indonesian occupation to join with them. So these were groups which supported the Indonesian invasion or opposed Fretland in the 1975 civil war that happened, brief civil war. So, and at the same time, Jose Ramos Horta, just in that same process, a couple of years later, Jose Ramos Horta resigned from Fretland also. So they've been independent players, but all within the framework of the independence struggle. And the National Council of Maiberia Resistance eventually became National Council of Timorese Resistance in 1998. So all of these people we're talking about were the leaders of that CNRT. And CNRT was able to be the vehicle for the independence, the referendum against integration into Indonesia, and therefore for independence. But it wasn't able to agree about a program for the future of the country. So it was dissolved in 2001, and the constituent parties all stood in the elections later that year. Mm. So that's explains some of the tension between them that you see today, that there was a separation happening in the 80s, there was the CNRT, then there was another separation. It's different phases of the history of their movement. But they know each other very, very well. There is obviously abrasiveness and so on between them, but especially Xanana Gusmão and Alkatiri and Fretland as a whole share a very similar political perspective, I think. They're nationalists, they're democrats, they're really committed to the poor people of Timor. They're not into sort of favouring the rich over the poor. They're sort of social democrats of some sort. Whereas Mr. Horta is more of a neoliberal, because he was actually, you know, very active in the diplomatic circles in the 1990s and the 80s when neoliberalism became the conventional wisdom, and he's never been a heavily ideological person. He's always said this from the very beginning, and so he's much more pro-US, pro-transnational corporation, and so on. You know, taking even that into account, you know, he's also someone who's demonstrated a whole lifetime of commitment to East Timor's people. And I believe emotionally he's right there with the others on that. So there's plenty of potential for them to work together. It's when they were able to be divided that the worst things happened in Timor. Now, some people are saying, well, Xanana launched the whole trouble against the Fretilin government, but I don't believe that at all. I just think that, especially after the event of May 25, which was the massacre of there was 30 to 40 Timorese police who were unarmed, who were fired upon, and in the end 12 died, and at least nearly all the rest were wounded. So that was a shocking event. And the Australian military forces landed that day and the next day, and from the next day, virtually, Xanana Gusmao was attacking at Al Qatiri and attacking the government. So, and that pattern hasn't changed up till now, but I think it might be changing. It might be changing now. So I think up until that point, he worked with the government to try to contain the problem. I think that there was more external forces, that is people in Australia, the United States, and maybe Indonesia, who put probably unbearable pressure on Xanana Gusmao to move against Al Qatiri. And I think that the role played by Four Corners and its allegations that he armed a hit squad, this was actually used directly to demand the resignation of the Prime Minister. And the subsequent investigations, I think, amply demonstrate now that there's no basis to that allegation at all. And therefore, you have to ask, well, looking back on all of those dynamics, who was behind that? And therefore, you have to ask about Four Corners, who put them in touch with Raylos. And I think you'll find there's somebody there in the Australian Embassy or somewhere, or maybe the US Embassy too. The other factors around this are that Major Reynado, who I think was the trigger for the really violent outbreaks, was very recently trained at the Australian Staff College. He has fairly enthusiastic barrackers for him in the Australian Staff College. And his wife was the manager of the Peace Corps and worked out of the US Embassy. So they're both extremely well-connected to be the players, you know, especially Major Reynado, to be the player he's turned out to be, that you wouldn't ask questions about it. And if you ask, well, why would it be possible that Australia or the United States might be into this? And you have to look at Indonesia, I think, that both the Australians, well, now we know that Australia has secretly been writing a security framework agreement with Indonesia. It was just signed this week in Lombok by Alexander Downer. So both the Australians and the United States military have been trying to formalise and normalise their relations with the Indonesian military, the TNI. The TNI look at East Timor and say, well, we can't trust either the United States or Australia. And I think damaging or demonstrating that the liberation movement, which is now the government of Timor, is no special friend of Australia or the United States, is really a price for these agreements, the normalisations of military arrangements which are going on. That's how I see it, and that's really the long-term pattern of Australian and US policy on Timor from the 1970s to today. And they've only been forced to change it by events like the Dili massacre and the outrage of 1999. So we're back to normal. It may seem a bit high-level analysis, but I think it's quite straightforward, in fact. And it's a tragedy that the Australian people, of course, don't have any sort of sympathy with this type of attitude. Australian people really want to help the Timorese people have a safe and prosperous life after all of the horror they've experienced. But I don't think that's the view shared in Canberra.
Well, that's a very trenchant analysis, Peter. Thank you for that. And just one last question. What is the standing of Fretilin now? They seem to be the target of a lot of the aggression, the violence. But what is the standing of the Fretilin Party itself?
Well, it's very difficult to tell. We're going to have an election in April 2007, which will be the test. So long as the election is able to take place, I know that Fretilin people now are working more or less in a clandestine way, because in Dili especially, it's a very unpredictable security situation, so they're very, very careful in their movements. People don't go around by themselves, they don't go around after 7 o'clock at night. So it's, you know, very difficult conditions for them. But this, even so, the information I'm getting is that there's a sort of a reconsolidation of the people behind Fretland, because as the months have passed, people can see more and more clearly that it's the government which has been the victim rather than the perpetrator of the violence, and that the people can't go back to their homes because of the threat of violence, and these armed groups are on the loose, and it's definitely not the government that's letting them be on the loose. It's, in the eyes of the people, the Australian military forces who are not arresting the armed groups. And this is one of the reasons why there's more and more hardening of attitudes about those Australian military forces, that they're not being proper in their involvement. There's also other information that, for instance, the Democratic Party leader, his name is Fernando de Araujo Lezama, has lost a lot of support in his own organisation because of his relative, you know, his really extremist and hysterical demands. He's one of the ones demanding that the parliament be immediately dissolved and the whole government sacked and replaced by the opposition parties. So this is now seen, I think, by even his own people as causing more trouble for ordinary people. So there's a chance that when the elections come next year, that in fact the PD will get less than its seven. The whole parliament's going to be smaller. It won't be 88, it will be 50, apparently. So everything will be a bit smaller. I think that it's a very fluid situation, but that public opinion in Timor, as far as we can tell, is now taking the view that the government is the victim and that the perpetrators are a real problem that have to be dealt with. I think that still Fretland is telling people to be patient, not to engage in violence, and to try to use political processes. And for instance, this recent call that Fretland put out for the leaders to reunite, this is really just directed at five people, so it's all personal, but it seems to be having some effects. So that's encouraging, and that could help us get to a period where people feel safer and that the election campaign can take place, and then everyone can see who's got political support in Timor.
Well, thanks, Peter. I don't know why we don't read this on the front page of The Australian, but community radio should get it out there.
That's right. I'm really pleased you've done this interview. Thanks very much. Thanks. Warwick.
I'm talking to Celine, who spent 15 months in East Timor developing a health centre out in the countryside, and she's also been involved in a project of which the East Timor situation is the third phase, and that is women in post-conflictive situations. And we have Celine with us here to tell us a little bit about that.
Hi, basically this research project was third phase of women post-conflict situations that was done also in Cambodia and Sri Lanka. The research was to analyse women's situation in Timor, how the conflict had affected women and what had been done since the conflict to assist women and women's role within East Timor society. So basically there were two phases of that project within East Timor. One was to interview staff members of Oxfam as well as partner organisations who worked with women and women's groups within East Timor. And the second phase was to interview women who were beneficiaries of these partnership organisations working with women or Oxfam's direct projects.
Yeah, obviously you would have been looking at the situation and the feelings of women after the trauma, I guess, of 1999. And were you able to find any... What were the results of that? Did you see the situation of women improving there, or were women working through this terrible situation that occurred in 1999, what it's now 2006, 7 years later.
Yeah, we found that women's situations have improved to a certain degree. Politically, they're much more active and included within society at the village level as well as at the district level and within the national government. I think it was enforced. A third of candidates within Timor elections had to be women, so that was a breakthrough, I think, for women's rights in Timor. Also within the Timorese...
It would be a breakthrough here in Australia, I think.
Definitely, all over the world. Then also the constitution, women's rights was reinforced, and so that was also another breakthrough. We found that many women were very traumatised from the conflict, as to be expected, and weren't dealing with those issues very well. There's not many structures in place to be able to support women, especially counselling or health-wise, access to any kind of services or assistance is quite rare, especially in the rural districts. As I mentioned before, some people have to travel 2 or 3 hours to even 5 hours to actually access health clinics, and that's just health clinics. So yeah, there's many women who are traumatised within East Timor and have little way of combating that. Also, there are many widows within East Timor, and they have little access to income. So there's not many organisations really set up to help these women, but Oxfam and its partners are doing things to try and alleviate this.
You know, imagine the loss of... there must have been terrible loss of family members and just family structures generally, you know. Yeah, I think we all know that that often falls back to the women to keep the family together.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, sources of income have been lost completely, and so many of these women are really struggling and even having a support base for themselves. They're even victims today within their communities because they're seen as different, and you could say sometimes that they might be targeted for sexual abuse. Mm. Much more than maybe other women within the community. On that note, sexual abuse is also a huge problem within East Timor. Maybe I would say little is really known about how it occurs, when it occurs, and it's not really discussed or appropriate to discuss within East Timorese culture. So that's a really huge problem. I would say people are talking about gender equality and have been talking about it much more since 99. Also, women's rights is on people's minds, but I don't think that many people actually understand completely what these terms mean. And they have a general idea that women's rights are the same or should be the same as men's rights, but putting this into application is a completely different matter.
Is there much participation by women within the community?
Women are much more active to a certain degree. Many women have been elected to village committees and are starting to be active in that way. It's still very much a patriarchal society, therefore making it really hard for women to even be able to participate in those committees or even be able to voice up their opinions. Another huge problem as well is family planning and access to healthcare for women who are pregnant or who are giving birth. Many women are very isolated from clinics, so give birth at home without the adequate medical assistance, and so they endanger themselves as well as their babies. Family planning is not very prominent within Timor. I guess there's a little bit of a conflict between the church, who advocate for natural family planning to occur, but who are against, I would say, for any other contraception to be used within Timor. And people don't really understand the concepts behind family planning. There's still a lot of education that needs to be done about family planning and how it is used and the benefits of family planning. People are scared, I would say, of contraception, especially the pill. And that originates from from Indonesian times, when the pill was inflicted upon women through injections when they were not actually asked if they wanted to take it or not.
Well, we'll call a spade a spade. I remember reading about this, and it was basically a forced sterilisation campaign, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's right. And so that trauma has stuck within many people's heads still in Timor.
Do you see things getting better for women in East Timor?
I do, and I think what's occurred since the last 6 years has been really beneficial in terms of politically, women are much more active or have the capacity. There are roadways for them to be able to be active within Timor society. It's actually getting them to be active, I think, which is the problem. And I think probably struggling with cultural traditions and norms will be a hard one to come over.
And I expect you'll be looking forward to going back there to make some input into this kind of work.
Yeah, no, I definitely look forward to doing that, hopefully in the next couple of years.
Well, good luck, and thanks very much, Celine.
Thank you.